I really do want to commend each of you for having the courage to come to this session. I do want you to know there are certain requirements for coming. That is that you have to have at least one or two gray hairs, or none at all. And yes, another possibility is that you can, if you have teenagers in your home, that automatically qualifies, or have had teenagers. I'm sure some of you have heard some definitions of midlife and that you're getting older, and there's a whole string of them, but some of them are that you know all the answers, but nobody asks you the questions. Another is that you sink your teeth into a steak and they stay there. And finally, that you decide to procrastinate but never get around to it. That's mine. I read something the other day that was helpful. It says, in your 20s, you don't care what people think about you. In your 30s, you begin to worry about what people think about you. And in your 50s, you discover they weren't ever thinking about you at all and didn't care. I'd like to tell you what my purpose in this session today will be, in other words, what we are going to do. Since we have longer than the normal hour period, there will be some good time for interaction, and we'll try and stop periodically for you to interact. But the first thing I'd like to do is to help you understand the concept of midlife transitions for yourself, just identifying things in yourself. The second thing is to give you insight to be able to help others and to be able to identify some things that may be happening with them. The third thing that I would like to do is to give you a little bit of a concept of what we've tried to do in the midlife book. And so just to know where I'm coming from in this session, we structured the book such that the middle section, chapter 6, gives the core biblical teaching and concepts and foundation under the whole thing. In fact, we struggled where to put it. Everything that comes prior to it is largely symptomatic. In other words, it is saying, yeah, that happens, men in midlife, women in midlife, depression, and so forth. Yeah, I can relate to those. But then finally you get down and say, now what? Okay, then the center part says, okay, here are the foundations. This is what you need to rebuild. And then the last part is applying those to specific issues of marriage and children and singleness and moving and a ministry, things of that nature. So it's application. The last part's application. The middle part is doctrine. The beginning part is more of stimulation and symptomatic. So conceptually, that is what we've done. So with the study guide, that's how you would approach it at some time if you're going to go through. The process is important. As we think about things in our lives, we do need to know symptoms. But if you go immediately from symptoms to application without a foundation, you've got the sand, you know, the house built on a sand. Now, you all will have a much better foundation than many. But there will still be some things that even we are missing in terms of our foundation, and so we'll try and build that. So my purpose in this session is to take that fundamentally middle section to give you the foundations, an overview of the foundations. And having done that, I believe it'll give you some ways to go back into other areas. It's interesting that we all do really change. We are not the same as we were in our 20s or our 30s. And if you're in your 40s, it's not the same as what it's going to be in the 50s or the 60s. We go through transitions. Personally, I do not subscribe to the concept of a midlife crisis. But I feel they're mostly very normal transitions of life. It just happens that in midlife, most or many of the emotional traumas that you go through in your lifetime occur. Your parents die. The children become teenagers. Their needs are becoming greater. You are seeing the end of your career and so forth. There are things like that that all seem to squeeze in to the 35 to 55 time period. When my mother was living, just after we finished the Your Job book, she said, well, are you writing anything else? And I told her that through that process, we'd gotten interested in this study on midlife. She said, well, what's midlife? I said, 35 to 55 is what we're defining. She said, that's not midlife. She says, I'm middle-aged. And besides, you're too young to write that. So, and we got some other indications, and we delayed the project for 2 or 3 years, even though we had the majority of the research done and had interacted with people and then did the work later on. What are some indicators that change is taking place in your life? One of the most interesting ones is sort of a free-floating anxiety. Have you ever awakened in the morning? Your stomach's churning and you don't know why? It's just sort of there. You know, nobody, you didn't have an argument. The kids aren't in trouble. Life is going along pretty well. There's nothing that you can just put your finger on of what's wrong. That's free-floating anxiety. Another is an issue of frustration. I think perhaps for men, maybe more than women, that frustration sets in, especially as related to your job. Because by the time you're 35, most people can see where their life is going to go job-wise. You can figure out if you're going to be successful. You can see in comparison to other people in your company. Now, I realize you folks are NAV staff, but if you've been in the secular world, you can pretty well tell what's happening. And at that point, a lot of your future career is established. And it can be a very discouraging thing to find out that I am not going to have the opportunity to do certain things. Or I've got 4 kids, and I haven't finished college, and I can't get a job that's a good one. And all those dreams of my 20s are destroyed because of just perhaps financial pressures and other things. So there is a sense of frustration of being trapped in something. Another issue is a feeling of worthlessness. Now you can see I'm going through some symptoms here right now. Just a sense that I am not really worth anything. Now you say, well, it's a theological issue, and all of us can say that until it happens to us. And all of a sudden, all those words of counsel come slinging back in your ear through your mind. Of all those wonderful platitudes, you say, why don't they work with me? Well, they do, but it's different when it's coming from inside instead of outside. I think men in midlife tend to get a more of a fear of financial matters. And it starts consuming their minds more. Kids going to college, how are we going to manage a house and so forth. Another is depression. Depression is probably the one most consistent indicator of going through a transition which is difficult for you. Now, I am not a person who is given to depression. You know, depression for me is about 20 minutes. But about 5 years ago, I really went down into depression. And some of you who went through that with me, you know it. And it was a frightening thing because I'd never seen myself like that before. But the depression is there. How many of you are not prone normally to depression? Can I just see your hands? Okay, of that group, just hold your hands up for a minute. Now, of the group of you who are not prone to depression, you know, just as a normal course of fear, has depression snuck up on you when you didn't expect it? Now, just put your hands down if that is not the case for you. Okay, see what I mean? It will come when you least expect it. Now, if you're a melancholic and depression is depression, that's just your lifestyle, all you do is go deeper. But for one who's not been used to it, it's a terrible experience. I think if you sense yourself entering into conflict on an increasing frequency with your spouse, with your friends, with your children, with those with whom you work, that is also an indication of some change. Now, the interesting thing is that all this is sort of going on internally. And then there are usually some matches, what I call crisis igniters, something that happens that all of a sudden, an event or a realization causes you to go down or to feel differently than you once did. For men and women, I believe they're different. Now, Mary and I have done this workshop together, and I tried to convince her she ought to stay here and give the women's portion. You'll just have to believe me that this is what she really would have said, were she to be here. For women, I think there are a number of items that start to make you think more about aging. And one of the most obvious, of course, is appearance. You look in the mirror, and you get upset at the wrinkles, and you have to use a little bit more makeup, or you see the sag. Mary told the story in our last seminar that we did a few days ago that some famous actress said in later years, "I've got all that I had when I was young. It's just 10 inches lower." You know, everything just starts to go. Health. Certainly the issue of menopause and the issue of some health problems for which women are just simply more prone are issues. They can be a great plague to you and can ignite some crises. You become upset at what seems to be your lack of capacity that you once had. Another is loneliness. The sense of being alone as your children begin to leave. We have three that we've booted out of the nest now, and we have one left. And as Lauren shared the other night, how he realized that the last one was going, and it was not an easy situation. I had a woman come up to me just 3 or 4 days ago at this conference I was at, and she says, "All of a sudden, I'm alone." She says, "One of my children went off to college, she was widowed, and one of her children was killed." And immediately, almost, in a matter of months, she had an empty nest. Well, that's a little bit of a shock, obviously. For many women, I believe, coming into midlife, there is a sense of powerlessness over her own destiny. Now, this is not a women's lib thing, but it certainly is influenced by that. A sense that her whole destiny is just totally ingrained with her husband. And there is a sense of self-worth that she begins to examine. Again, we can say glibly that's a theological problem. Well, maybe so. But you cannot counter your feelings on some things like that. One thing we've discovered is many people, perhaps not you folks because of your background, but certainly as we look at the church, abroad church, women get at that age and find out that they're empty spiritually. They've got nothing to offer. They're beautifully dressed, look nice, and their only self-esteem is in how they look because there is nothing internally to give. They have not had a devotional life. They've not had depth in the Word. They've never grappled with issues personally. And so that's where we need to be able to help people there because that is one of the solutions, certainly. So there are a number of areas like that that women could think about. Men, let's talk about you for a minute. For men, I think one of the key things that will happen to you is that you will come to a point in your jobs where you have a lack of motivation. Those things which once just turned you on, and you couldn't wait to get up in the morning. I have never been where I couldn't wait to get up in the morning. That's just my body chemistry. I can't go to bed at night. That's my deal. But nevertheless, you lose motivation. You've seen it in the ministry. It's happened to you, I bet. How many of you have had that experience just a little bit in some things? Yeah. And it's mysterious. You say, nothing has changed. But yet some of that motivational thing is not there. Unfortunately, there's one other issue that comes up for men, some for women, but I believe for men more than for women, a new onslaught of sexual lust, which you thought you'd left behind you in your 20s. Another issue is this business of fear. Things start creeping in, fear of where I will go, what I will do, what I will become, whether my ministry is credible, whether my job will continue, whether we will have enough money to pay for the kids going through school. And certainly a man's life does center so much around his career. And when a person is told, even though he may have known it internally, that there is a certain limit or kind of ministry or kind of thing that he can do, surely it has an effect on you. Because all of us like to think we're limitless. I think one of the things that really hit me in 77 when I had a real downer, and I'll tell later maybe a little bit about that, was that I think I had started to believe what people said about my capacity. And it just wasn't true. I do have limits. And when I started getting kids of teenagers, and all the other emotional things, I've got limits. And to that point, I'd kind of thought, well, man, I can do anything I put my mind to. And I just found it wasn't true. It just simply wasn't true. Finally, for men too, there are physical changes. When you go downstairs and huff and puff, you do get a little worried. And for someone who is a bit on the macho side for most of their lives or have any of that kind of drive, it is a real problem. You know, we worry about the little roll around the middle, and you ought to some. And you start losing strength, and your knees start to give out, and your back starts giving you problems. And you can't play racquetball anymore, and you've got to restrain yourself to ping pong, or whatever it is. That does have an emotional effect on you. You sense dying, in a way. And that does hurt us. So, those are some of the symptoms. And symptoms are things that we all sense in some way. But symptoms are only a part. They are there to tell us that we have some needs. I'd like to stop here for just a few moments and to see whether this is part of your experience. Are there some other symptoms that I haven't mentioned that you have particularly noticed, either for yourself or with someone else? And let's just stop here for a moment for questions or just comments on that, because I believe we've got time in the session. Yeah, Dave?
I don't know if it's true for everybody else, but my thought is going through that there's this desire to try to evaluate where I've been, where I was going, you know, almost to realize, hey, I'm not going to live forever, and I'm halfway there, whatever it might be. And you start thinking, what do I really want to do?
Yeah, total reevaluation of your life. That's an excellent one, because you come to a point and you say, finally, I've got to figure out where I've been and where I'm going and why I'm going to do it, and do I want to give my life to it? That's very good, because it's a critical look at yourself for the first time, and it's scary. John?
What puzzles me is the seismographic activity in this area that's constantly going on, you know, pushing these hills up higher.
Mm-hmm.
Every year, it seems like there's been enough people. And another thing that puzzles me, why do they keep adding steps to these stairs all the time?
Yeah. Yeah, your body does react to the same number differently, doesn't it? Yep, that's true, John. Any other thoughts? Yes, Ken?
I found a more reluctance to deal with what I consider to be my weaknesses. And kind of settling in to, okay, this is where I am. These are my strengths. I'm going to go with that. And the things that I have been working on now, they're going to remain weaknesses, and we'll just go with the other.
Right. So to stop really learning and changing and dealing with your weaknesses is an issue. Yeah. And there's some good to that, because you know, you don't want to sit working on your weaknesses. It's kind of like my daughter. She said her prayer request for this year, she's 18, is that she'd get up to 5 feet tall. Well, you know, it says by being anxious, can you add one cubit to your stature? See, there's some things we can't change. And it's very good to figure those out and to come to grips with them. And we'll talk about that in a little bit. Sarah Adler, who is a noted leading lady of Jewish stage, she never admitted to her true age. And one time she was being interviewed by a reporter, and he said, well, Madam Adler, I'd like to ask you a very personal question. How old are you really? She said, 67. He said, well, Madam, that's a little puzzling. I just interviewed your son, Jack, and he's 60. And she said, well, he lives his life and I live mine. Or people, on the last prayer card that came out from us, you know, we had that picture. Some of you may have gotten it. And people look at that one, especially young fellow. I could have kicked him in the shins. But he looked at it and says, how long ago was that taken? He says, you look too young on here. That doesn't look like you. You doesn't have all that gray hair and so forth. And they go on like that. And it does make you sense your age. You know, one of the interesting things, age permits you to have the stature from which you can minister legitimately. But our society does not approve of it. And in fact, our Christian society doesn't always approve of it. Have you ever wondered why it's so difficult to find a godly, deep speaker for some conferences who don't have an axe to grind? You know, like Mr. J. Oswald Sanders that we're having here. They're few and far between, folks. Because something happens before they get there. Satan has a way of just cutting people out of the pattern. I think one of the verse I write in the front of this book every time I sign it is Psalms 92:14. In old age they shall still be bearing fruit. They shall be full of life and vitality. Isn't that a great verse? I don't know what old age is. But whatever it is, when we keep going, we want to develop. Now, let's go to another section. I'd like to talk with you about a concept of reserves. In the Proverbs, we've got a passage of Scripture in Proverbs 6 that's very familiar to you, but perhaps we don't pay as much attention to it as we ought to, because somehow most of us cannot come to grips with our own frailty. And in fact, for those who have never been sick, hardly a day in our lives, to get sick, you almost think you've entered into sin. I must have done something wrong. Proverbs 6, 6 through 11, which many of you know, go to the ant, O sluggard, observe her ways and be wise, which having no chief, officer, or ruler, prepares her food in the summer and gathers her provision in the harvest. How long will you lie down, O sluggard? When will you arise from your sleep? A little sleep, a little slumber, a little rest, folding of the hands to rest, and your poverty will come in like a vagabond, and your need like an armed man. And then over in Proverbs 10:5, it says, he who gathers in summer is a son who acts wisely, but he who sleeps in harvest is a son who acts shamefully. Have you ever heard the phrasing, the spring of your life, the summer of your life, the autumn of your life, and the winter of your life? I'm not sure that God had in mind that colloquial expression, but it does fit, doesn't it? You gather in the summer, and you build for the future. Now, I think the greatest danger to many of us is that we simply do not build for the future. We're impatient to get on with our contribution or doing what we're doing, and we have a great tendency to burn out. So I'd like to just share with you a couple items. First, just a concept of reserves. Now, if you would look at your life something like this on the overhead, let me put that up and we'll see if we can get it. Can you see that all right? All right. Just think of your life as a bucket. And that bucket's filled with water. But like the old Volkswagen cars prior to 59 or something like that, you remember how you used to hit that reserve line and you run out of gas and you turn the switch over into the reserve tank? Some of you might remember that. Some of you have never seen one of them. But nevertheless, that's what happened. Now, if your life's a little like that, you've got an operating tank, then you come down to the reserve level and there's some there. You dip down into it. However, not everybody looks like that bucket. A lot of people look like that. And the reserve level is almost non-existent. The minute you go below that operating line or the reserve level, it's as though you're scraping rust and gunk off the bottom of the bucket. And it goes out very, very quickly. And so one of the things we want to say is, well, how do I build up this reserve? Wouldn't it be great if in our life we had a Volkswagen engine or a tank that the minute we hit the reserve level, we just momentarily stopped, pushed a button, and then went on. We'd know we had gone into the reserves, right? But the problem is not quite knowing. And what's worse is if you know and can't do anything about it. Just take sleep as an example. That's a very good, easy example because you can remember times when you could go on 4 hours a night for 6 days. And get one good night's sleep and be right back. Well, today that may not be the case. After you run down, You need that 7 or you need that 8. And you go on one night with 4 and it's as though you were being embalmed. You get up the next morning and it's confirmed in the mirror. And so we just have a situation where our reserve changes. Now really our life doesn't look like that bucket, but rather I believe our life looks something like this. Where we're 3 buckets. The physical, the spiritual, and the emotional. Now this is a picture, a snapshot of one person's life. This person is a jogger. So you see they've really got that physical up there. They're doing well. They've got a deep reserves and they're well above the reserve line. They rarely ever get down. They eat well and so forth. But however, jogging at 5 sort of ruins quiet time. And so their spiritual level, though not too bad, they're still operating out of their reserves. I'm sure many of us during this week are operating out of spiritual reserves from our personal time with God because it's just, you know, we're so busy. And you start longing for a longer time with the Lord. And emotionally, the person is strong, but starting to dip into the lines, or below the reserve level, below that line. Now, what would be a good exercise for you, whenever you're feeling a little crummy, to draw a picture like that of yourself. And if you think for a moment, okay, where would you be physically on that bucket? Have you got a high reserve level, a low one, and are you operating out of your reserves now or out of your plenty? How about spiritually? How about emotionally? And if you were counseling someone, I would think that would be one thing that I would want them to do, would you just draw me a picture of yourself? We can't see. How do you ask them how they're doing spiritually? You can, of course, but it's hard to perceive sometimes. But people will be very accurate on that. Now, this picture is still not really accurate. Something is missing. Can you guess what it is? What is missing from that illustration? Pardon me? The intellectual? No, it's not a bucket. You could put that in. I just put that mostly into the emotional area. Now, we could put it in. It's not another bucket.
Would it be the rate of change?
Okay, the rate of change, that's very close. The fact is that these are not independent. So you see, the fact is when I go down physically, what happens to me emotionally? Okay, when I go down spiritually, what happens to me emotionally? When I go down emotionally, what happens to me physically? All right? So really, it looks more like this. Now, I am an engineer and I know hydraulics, and I know that picture was not made up by an engineer. My secretary did that for me. And what you really have is a leak between them. You have a small orifice that just sort of leaks at a small rate. And those emotional leaks, the physical leaks, and after a while, they start leveling out or they start draining one another. But the source of the whole thing you can see on that illustration is God Himself. Unless it has the foundation of God Himself, it will not work. Now that's one thing to get the picture of that. By the way, does that make sense to you? The question now comes out, what do I do to build the reserves? You see, I really honestly want to build my reserves. But how do I do it? So that's what I'd like to review next. First of all, let's talk about physical reserves. Now, I want to be very simple on the issue of physical reserves or the whole concept of reserves. I don't think we should get complicated. The first thing has to do with eating habits. Now, I'm not a big one on just big diets or buying everything at the health food store or whatever. I think we can get off, in that area if we're not careful. The key is just moderation of amount and the nutritional value of it. Just use common sense in the way you conduct yourself physically. And the older you get, the more your weight is going to be a hassle to you. It'll hinder you. Not only is it harder to get rid of, and if you'll just not be as concerned about the cosmetic value of what hangs over as to the total weight issue and the whole of the physical and to what you eat. The second thing is the issue of physical exercise. Mary is a beautiful example of this. Mary, about 7 or 8 years ago, began to jog. And there's this cartoon I saw about someone going out jogging, and they are panting and huffing and puffing. It's on Sunday paper, you know, where there are about 8 frames. And finally, they're panting. I don't think I can go any further. I'm going to die. My lungs are burning. My whole head is pounding. And then they collapse at the end of their run. And their partner coming along says, "Next week, we'll get out of the driveway." Mary was like that. She couldn't run a block. And then she just started doing it and started building up, and she really loves it. I don't love it. I don't enjoy it at all. I do it a little, but and she is always a good prod to me to get some physical exercise. Probably the best and simplest physical exercise is walking. It won't give all the cardiovascular help. You don't need to jog. You don't need to be a runner. And whatever you do, my counsel is do it in moderation. Anything that we do in excess will end up hurting us physically in most cases. Now, you can connect your discipline and all that to it, but I think there are other areas of discipline that are just as important. The other is the issue of rest. All of us need to balance what we need in the way of rest. In Psalm 127 and verse 2, it says, "It is vain for you to rise up early, to retire late, and to eat the bread of painful labors. For he gives to his beloved even in his sleep." Rest and sleep are one of the greatest blessings that God gives us. One of the reasons many people turn to alcohol and drugs is they can't sleep. And sleep is the next best escape we have. And you know what it is when you can't sleep. Your body gets run down. You don't rest. We just need to balance ourselves. At our staff conference out in the Pacific region, Mr. Sanders spoke to us this past year, and I spoke one evening on stress, and then he went on with his testimony. He made a statement the next day that sort of stunned everybody. The women, you could just hear a breath of relief, and the men couldn't believe what they were hearing, and it was this. "Do you realize," he said, "that women on the average need an hour more sleep per night than men?" Just that simple statement. Yeah, you can see the women just sort of, whew. And the men says, "You're kidding." And all that conflict. Many, you know, Mary feels very guilty when she takes a nap. However, she gets up at 5 a.m. Well, I'm still sacked out. She's just an early morning person. And then she has to take a nap because she stayed up about as late as I did. But there's still that grappling with the guilt on our sleep. So we do need to guard our rest and make sure that we get it. The last thing is the issue of physical examinations. And I want to encourage you to get them periodically. You don't have to pay the whole bundle that for the extensive physical, but I think we do need to have the blood test, the women, of course, pap smears, and to just make sure that we catch the obvious. Physicals won't catch everything by any means, but we do need to do that, and over 40, I believe, every 2 years is a reasonable period of time. Do you have any other thoughts on the physical? Yes, Dave?
I would think that stress would be related to physical reserves.
Well, stress is related to all of it. From my study of stress, which I did some more on it for this last conference, that it comes from a combination of stress drains people differently. Stress will, for some people, decreases your hunger for the word and thus drains you spiritually. Other people, the stress wears you out physically, and the others emotionally. Almost always, the emotional issue will be there. And it probably is the one that's the most scary to us, because none of us want to be thought of as having a nervous breakdown. You know, many of you know, if you've been ill, it's almost a relief sometimes to find a physical cause. Because then you say, "Oh, it's not in my head." Well, I don't know whether it's in your head, but there is an emotional side to us, and we are emotional people, and we do go down emotionally. Yes, John?
I'd like to add an encouragement on that diet bit. I'm not necessarily an example of how to do it, but I've talked to a lot of people, like hypoglycemia and things of this nature, and you go on a rather restricted diet, and it just revolutionizes their life. The way they feel, their energy, they get off with not being hooked on sugar. Sugar withdrawal is quite an emotional thing. And to what extent I've experienced it, why, it's really worth the trouble. But those who've gone further than I have really testify to not the being hung up on the health food bit, but just the common sense of knowing what to eat and when to eat and how to select it in the line, like to know that bread and potatoes and pie and toast and rolls are all bread, you know.
Right.
Peas, you know, just know that you make the whole meal of bread. And a little bit of stuff like that is revolutionary, really.
Yeah, it is. And just to know what you're eating. And that's where I say use common sense on the nutritional aspect of your diet. Salt is one of the greatest enemies that we have, and there's been a lot of publicity on salt. And, of course, sugar is another. We get far more than we ever need. We have one child who is has a particular sensitivity to that, was hyperactive when they're young, and we took her off all preservatives and certain sugars and so forth, and you know, she knows how to control her diet now. And when she starts getting uptight, she knows what's happening. Now, we're all that way to some degree, but our bodies are built differently and consequently compensate for it. So, that's it. Okay. Go to the next issue, the emotional reserves. This is a little harder. I believe one of the greatest emotional encouragements for a married person is the marriage relationship. It is either a downer or an upper. It rarely is neutral. And we need to see that God does supply for us emotionally in that. And if that is not in order, it is going to be a constant drain to us. The second relates around our job and our career, whether it's a housewife or whether it's someone in the ministry or whether it's somebody working out in a secular context, that a job is going to drain you emotionally or build you up. You know, the work of a laboring man or the sleep of a laboring man is sweet. But see, so much of our work today is not labor. It does not wear us out physically. It wears us out emotionally. And the more we enjoy it, of course, the better off you are. But I just want to make a caution to you here. It's my experience, both personally and in relationship to counseling a lot of people and doing a lot of those seminars on work, that most jobs are about 90% drudgery. It's a rare person that's able to have 90% of things that are just super, boy, I love doing it and I want to do it. Most of us get into very repetitive issues. It's over and over again. You could do it blindfolded, whether it's making disciples or filling teeth or operating or whatever it is. And there are things about my job I don't like. Everybody has that. It's just part of life. But we must realize that our attitude toward it will have a great effect on us emotionally. The next area in emotional reserves is the issue of children. I know nothing that will drain me faster than a phone call from my children, like came yesterday at lunch. And, you know, so for the afternoon, Mary cries, I get worried, I go back and pray, and we make some calls last night and yesterday afternoon. Wasn't a big thing. But it was a big thing inside. It really was. But isn't it interesting how when they were little, it was one thing. But now when they're teenagers and in their 20s, and when we can't do anything about it fundamentally, that all it just affects us so deeply emotionally. Now, I believe God knows that. And God knows our frame. He knows that we're as dust. He knows that our lives are intertwined with the lives of our children. And he is at work. But it's not simple. And there are times that it's going to drain you, and there are times that you'll be so encouraged. But unfortunately, it's like a roller coaster. And one day it'll be great and the other day next. And you just have to, it's not. You have to realize that. The other issue is recreation. You may not have a problem with television, but I think television is the antithesis of recreation. I've often used the illustration that it's amusement. The Latin word muse means to think. The prefix a means not, to not think. That's amusement. And if you recognize it, most television programming is so that you do not have to interact mentally with it, but you can emotionally intertwine yourself with it without even trying, without any effort at all. You know, why is it, for instance, that people watch Love Boat instead of 60 Minutes or whatever it is when given the choice? One, you have to think, and the other, you don't. And so let me just urge you, in the area of recreation, to make sure that it's in your life, whatever it is that recreates you. You know what Francis Cosgrove does would drive me nuts. You know, his little trains. Pardon me, Francis, if you ever listen to this tape or something. But, you know, I couldn't do it. But he just loves it. It's an emotional thing to him. Bob Stephen goes out, and I think you like to build and to work on things, don't you? Maybe repair cars. I go out, and I get frustrated. I almost want to swear. You know, I can do the simplest thing, and it can take me 25 times as long. But on the other hand, there are certain aspects of my work or of writing or something that are emotional uplifters to me. Every person has to discover what recreates them. And normally, it's when we're doing something that we are not required to do. That's why it's important that you develop certain things that are not just, quote, part of your job description. And finally, we need to avoid certain emotional drains that can be very difficult on us. For instance, I think one of the greatest emotional drains is unresolved conflict. When you are in conflict with someone, it just eats your lunch constantly. Another issue has to do with being suspicious of what other people are thinking about you, or overscheduling. And now if the emotional drain is your spouse, you can't avoid that. You've just got to live with it. But it is a point that we must, at some point, say, okay, there are certain circumstances that are not right for me. And just avoid being in them. Now, you can't always avoid them. You can't always run away. But I think each of us know the kinds of circumstances that really get after us emotionally. Okay, I'm going to go to one other section, and then we'll stop for some specific questions. What time does this workshop get over? 12:15. Okay, we're doing all right. And then we'll have some interaction and some questions. The last one is the issue of building spiritual reserves. Now, you all are all good navigators, and as navigators, we've got systems and structures and plans and disciplines and checklists and ways to do it and ways to build it and when to have it and how to make it work and why it doesn't and how many days to do it. And, you know, I got to thinking and communicating this to people who haven't been through some system like that. It's got to be simpler than that. It just, life in the with God has got to be simpler than that. So I said, okay, what are the rudimentary elements that I would say we must have to build the spiritual reserves? I almost hate to share this among a bunch of navigators because some things aren't here that you'd like to see. The first, of course, which everybody will agree, is a daily time of just reading the Word and prayer. And if you can get any of that coming into our lives, reading the Word and prayer, a quiet time, a devotional time in whatever structure it is, and if you're helping somebody in that, 10 minutes or 12 minutes or 15, but just that daily intake. You know, we need that too. We need that refreshing time with God that is not part of our job description. We don't have a quiet time because it's expected of us, but we must have a quiet time because of our relationship with the Lord. The second issue is that of personal Bible study. I spoke at a pastor's conference at Multnomah last May, and so I had about 50 or so pastors in a workshop. And I said, would you gentlemen either verify or counter this statement that 95% of the laymen in your evangelical congregations never study the Bible using pen and pencil and paper? Never. And they agreed. They agreed. Very few people really do Bible study. Even some of the small Bible classes are Bible teaching. And I believe that one of the greatest weaknesses to spiritual roots is that people do not know the Word for themselves. They know the doctrine. They've had great teaching. You have things that come down on us. We tell them what to believe, or somebody does. They believe it. They affirm it. But they never get the roots grappling in our own souls that go into the Word. And I believe that comes out of Bible study, not out of a devotional life. Now, there's one item. There's a third one. And what would you think the third item is? Ah, that's right. I usually have to go around. This is quite a group. Fellowship. The fellowship of believers, that we need the church. It is not just the fellowship of navigators, which is good at some points, but we need a fellowship of believers with whom we relate. And the fellowship, of course, is not a social issue. It's not forsaking the assembling of ourselves together as a manner of some is, but encouraging one another day by day. That element of fellowship which keeps us from sin. Most of us know that when a person is getting into sin or gets down, they tend to withdraw from fellowship, right? I realize that many of our fellowships are not that. Walking into a church that seats 2,000 for a worship service is not fellowship. There is some, we need it in smaller groups and in segments and in Sunday school classes and in small group Bible studies and in a lot of different ways. But we need it. Wherever you get it, you really do need it. You know what the greatest danger is for you and I as full-time workers? As people who are respected, and the older you get, the more you'll be respected. Not that you deserve it anymore. But the more distant you'll become is a lack of accountability. That nobody ever checks up on our quiet time or asks us if we're memorizing scripture or asks what we're struggling about. And so I would like to urge you that in your ministry you have someone other than your spouse with whom you are accountable for the basics, for just the nitty-gritty of the Christian life in some areas. And it's so easy to get away from this and not have anybody with whom we have an agreement that they have freedom in our lives and hold us accountable. I think it's a two-way street, but we need it very much. Yes? Great. Yeah, and that's good. And that'll be good on some of the basics. There are some other areas you want to be checked out on, too. You know, how are things coming with your kids? Do you pray with your wife? And, you know, just whatever it is, little things. Now, I think we need to realize that reserves are not built fast. A friend of mine really had a downer. And the question was asked, how long will it take me to build back up? And the answer was, about as long as it took you to go down. I remember, some of you know Roger Brandt, who was out at the Air Force Academy here with me. And I remember when we were going to go over and build shelves for my bookshelves. And Roger's a real craftsman. And I'm more the orange crate variety. And so I made the plan up. I have an engineering background, so it's no problem to make a plan. And I expected we'd go over and knock that thing out in one night. You know, I had all the lumber bought. I had everything there. He had the equipment, and we'd just do it. Oh, man, he'd measure, and he'd measure again. Then he'd plane this, and he'd sand this. And night after night after night we went on. And I was ready to go. I was getting tired of this thing. But he just keeps going. But it's lasted. I've moved it in every home I've been in. It is beautiful. But see, it takes the time. To build the reserves in our lives takes time. And it has to come out over a period of years. And when there's been an area of our lives that we've neglected for a long time, it's going to take time to build it back up. It really will. Now, when I had a real emotional downer in 77, I could give you a lot of the details. I put some of it in the midlife book. I just surprised myself tremendously at my reaction. I was a bit angry and I was embarrassed. I was down. And it just took some time. For an entire year following that time, I was very reluctant in my contribution in the RD meetings. I'm not sure the other guys noticed it particularly. I really lost confidence because I was embarrassed at the way I had responded. And it hit my ego and my pride. So whereas before I'd mouth off at the drop of a hat, you know, and give my opinion on most anything, all of a sudden I felt an inner restraint. And it took about a year for me personally to really rebuild my confidence. Well, I got back physically in about 2 months. But I think it took time to rebuild that. That's probably going to happen again. Because we aren't all that wise about how we measure our output. But when it goes, you've just got to understand, we all do, that it will take time to rebuild. Okay, let's stop for a moment and go into a few, maybe you have some observations, some scriptures. I've got a lot of scriptures written down. We could go into Psalm 102 and 103 and see David's heart and his problems and his depression and crying out to God, being like a owl in the desert and a pelican in the wilderness and so forth. And you see David really going down. And there's some comfort to that, to know that godly people do have problems. Some thoughts or questions before I go into the next section. Yes. Right. Yeah. That was a great concern, and that initial thought was one that really stimulated Mary and I to begin doing some thinking on that. We have so valued our friendships over the years with people, navigators and non-navigators. They've been such a refreshing thing to us, and I should have included that, and I had it in my notes, I believe, that building emotional reserves is largely one of the main things is to have friends. But I really believe that we need friends outside the staff also. What happens? Have you ever seen people have left staff and the way they've been treated at times or something, they just feel kind of like they're a leper? Well, see, that ought not to happen, for one thing. But if our friendship is only in the context of our staff, it often is what I call a functional friendship. I'm friends because I must. Not friends because I want or need. In fact, one of the greatest traumas is you have a supervisor that you want to share his heart with, your heart with, or theirs with you, and they're not with you enough. I mean, you know, Carolyn and Denny are down in Pasadena. We love them. We want to be with them. But frankly, we don't get enough of that time. I see Denny more than Carolyn. If we were close to one another, our friendship could deepen. But how do you do it at a distance, see? Unless that friendship's been built. So we really have been have emphasized in our own lives a building of quality friendships, just one or two in each place we've been, with some other people. And with some of the staff, too. It's not exclusive to others. Yeah. Well, I think if you're a little older than them, you have to take the initiative. Sometimes they've come out of our ministry. Sometimes they've just been other people. Sometimes they've been just peers, and you just develop the friendship, and you're not ministering to them. The key issue is you have to seek the friendship. And we've laid down some guidelines on how to do that. It's not simple. It has to click, doesn't it? You can't be friends with everybody. Have you ever been with someone, even godly people, but yet there's a barrier? Or it's kind of like sandpaper. You just don't get along. You say, oh, it's unspiritual. I don't get along. Why not live with what is? We are different personalities. And at different times in our lives, we change. John.
Sure, you have any input on how younger staff wives can build these friendships? Sometimes it's a little awkward in various levels of staff get-togethers, you know, up and down. When, I don't know, we guys, I think we just have a camaraderie because we work together, whether or not we've known each other, like you and I haven't known each other all that much, but we have similar problems. We just kind of drawn together, see?
Mostly the problems.
But our what?
Mostly the problems.
Mostly problems. But we enjoy it. But
right.
The girls put together, although you may have older gals like mine and younger gals, but they don't necessarily...
Right.
They're nice and spirit-filled, but they don't open their hearts to each other.
Right.
You know?
Well, there's a fear. There's always a fear of openness. You know, Why I'm Afraid to Tell You Who I Am, that book.
What should the younger wife do? What do a younger couple do over the years?
Well, let me back up just a little bit to two issues that you've asked there, John, and I don't have all the answers, but I'll give you a couple ideas. This is getting into that topic a bit. I'd love to have done something on friendship here, but wasn't asked, so that's life. First of all, there's a difference between the way men develop friendships and women develop friendships. And I think a beautiful illustration of it is a quote from Betty McDonald's, The Egg and I. Have any of you ever seen that? It's an old movie and a book and so forth. And Betty McDonald then says, well, you know, women, when they make friendships, they want everything to be perfect. They have a pattern in their mind that they want this friend to fit. Now, if the friend misses it by about 10%, they're willing to tolerate that, but only if that 10% is shaping up rather nicely. But she says, now take men. You know, my husband, he says, he's got this friend that he goes fishing with. Now, he smells. He discourses largely in four-letter words. He hates women. He's nobody that I like. And he doesn't even notice it, because they like to fish together.
I can understand that.
Yeah. And he says... And so they go on for years at an even temperature, because they aren't the demands made. So this first thing is... that women in generally are more demanding in their expectations of the relationship than men. Now, I'm sorry I'm getting off into another topic here, but we had to argue this one out. Now, one of the problems was that in our surveys, we took 300 surveys of people between the ages of 18 and 82, I think it was, and all the men, an equal number of men, said that I value in my friendship sharing deeply, as did the women. Puzzled us to no end, because that's not what we expected out of the data. But then it clicked. What the men mean by sharing deeply is very different from what women mean by sharing deeply. And men, that's why in your home, when you come home from this trip, those of you whose wife is not here said, how'd it go? Oh, I'm fine. Well, who'd you see? Well, a lot of people. And they name someone. Well, I don't know. I think they were there. Yeah. How were they? Fine. And, you know, pump, 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 pump. Whereas my wife comes home, and there's a dialogue of detail that goes on.
And on.
And on. And then I say, occasionally I say, is there a point to this? And then I realize I've said the wrong thing. But nevertheless, see, there's a different expectation even on friendship and marriage. Now, I have had men who expect the same, you know, who expect that, who have said that if someone is their leader, that he's got to be their friend and the guardian of their soul and everything else. Now, I think that's nice, but when you're 200 miles separate, how are you going to do that? Okay, now, how can a young wife do it? I want to point out that difference. The men tend to relate functionally. Women tend to relate relationally. Now, for a young wife, the danger she feels is that she will reveal something that will hurt her husband, and that his career will be jeopardized in some way by revealing a problem in the marriage, for instance. Now, folks, and you women who are older, if that happens, that young women come and share with you, you are a guardian of that information. And it maybe ought not to go to your husband. It maybe ought not to go to leadership or whatever. Do you see what I mean? The biggest destroyer in friendships is gossip and breaking confidences. And we're great at it, you know, for prayer and for decisions or whatever it is. But that's one of the hindrances, John, is people are afraid, you know, they've done it once or twice and they got burned. But for a young wife, she has to be willing to extend herself. Another fact is the young wife maybe have a lot of room in her relational capacity to fill up. An older wife's already filled up. She can't handle another. So one comes and says, I want to be your friend. And the other says, I'd like that, but I don't have any more room in my capacity for friendships. And that's where we get into different kinds of friendships. That was a long answer to just some ideas on that. And we tried to go into a fair amount of detail on that. Okay? Yes, Dave?
Just one, on building emotional reserves, some other thing there is your extended family can be quite uplifting.
Or the other way. Yeah, one way or the other. There's some people you want to move out of their area, and some it's really a... Yeah, that's right.
Parents or uncles or anything. Mm-hmm.
That's right. Yeah. By the way, that reminds me, in a last seminar I gave, Mary and I gave on this just last week, it's very fresh in my mind, one person came up and said, you left something out. And that is that at our age, we're starting to get dependent parents. And that is a great load. Feel responsibility, especially if there are only one or two in your family. So that's another issue. That's a real emotional load on us. Mary and I are moving into that situation now. Well, let me go on for a little bit, and then we'll just take some time at the end. Now, I believe that there are biblical answers to practical questions, and I'm sure you believe the same thing. And I would like to share with you what I feel the four biblical concepts are, which are mandatory to building roots that will take you through hard times. And so as you minister to yourself and to others, these are four topics that have to continually be hammered on. Because if they aren't, it'll catch them up later. The first of those has to do with answering the question, is God still in charge, or what is the doctrine? Sovereignty of God. The sovereignty of God. Now, I've written the verses down in that handout, Psalm 50, 10 through 12, Psalm 89, 11, Romans 8, 28, Psalm 139, 13 through 16, and Isaiah 55, 8, and 9. Now, we won't go in and read all of those because those are all demonstrations, just sample demonstrations of the sovereignty of God. But now, what are the practical results of not accepting God's sovereignty? It's one thing to preach, like I am doing now, and another to live. I mean, I grapple with this myself. And having learned the lesson once doesn't mean you learn it for the next time. First of all, when we don't accept God's sovereignty, it doesn't make any difference God is sovereign whether we accept it or not. So the acceptance is simply in ourselves. The first is we get fearful. Fear that God no longer can protect us. The second is we become rebellious, because you see, if the protection is not there, we become rebellious against that which we thought would protect us. Then bitterness. You become bitter against God, saying, why, God, if you really loved me, then you wouldn't have allowed this to happen. The other thing is to fight God for control. If God is not sovereign, then I am sovereign in my life, or at least something else is, and you start fighting. The next is an uncertainty. It just leads to doubt and wavering and wondering if God will eventually do something about this. And finally, it really casts doubt on the veracity of God's love. Does he really love us? So those are practical results of not accepting God's sovereignty. Have you got that? Okay, I'll wait just a moment. Next, I'd like to talk about what the practical results are of accepting God's sovereignty. When we really come to grips biblically with the fact that God is sovereign, then I'll come back if we need some more on that. First, I think we have a peace, a real sense of peace. My peace I give unto you, my peace I leave with you, as the world gives, and so forth. See, God gives the peace. The second thing, we have a rest. Come unto me, all you that labor and are heavy laden, and I will give you rest. There's a sense of resting in his sovereignty. There's a confidence that God will act in his due time. It's a building of our faith that we believe God in what he said. We claim those promises for our kids, for ourselves, for our lives, for our ministry, for our future, for our parents. And it leads to an optimism. You know, that we do become optimistic instead of pessimistic about life. One of the greatest dangers of that we face as we grow older is cynicism. We've just seen too much. You know, that's one thing that it's a barrier between you and I ministering to younger people. I'll never forget, after teaching here at the academy for 6 years, my last semester, after teaching graduate courses for and upper division courses for most of that time, I went back and taught the basic course. Young cadets, you know, goofing off and all that. And it was very frustrating because I knew all the tricks. See, they couldn't pull anything over my eyes. I'd heard every answer. And so I became intolerant. It's part of the fun is being able to pull the wool over a teacher's eyes in some situations, you know. And when the teacher's young, and that's why they usually put rookie instructors in, everybody's trying to figure out what's going on. And it's kind of like that with you and me. We've heard the same problems so many times, the things people are grappling with, and you say, listen, why don't you get your head screwed on? You know, it's so obvious what the answer is. And you just get impatient and a little cynical about what they're saying. And you understand what I mean? And it brings a separation between us. Now, the results of accepting God's sovereignty also are that we understand that God made me like I am physically. That's quite a statement. He made me so my body would accept cancer cells. He made me so that I have a weakness in a particular area of my body. So he says he knows my frame, that we are as dust. The second thing is that God made me like I am emotionally. Now, Freud says you're a product of your environment, but God is in control of that environment. You were born into a particular home with a particular set of parents, a family, an environment, a neighborhood that molded you in your personality and emotionally, not just your genes. So I agree that the environment makes a lot of difference. And we are different, but God is still in charge. We are like we are emotionally. Some of you are weaker than others emotionally. Some of you cry. Some of you get mad. Some of you have to constantly battle issues of sin relating to your emotional responses to things, or lack thereof. Some are cold as a fish, you know, don't respond emotionally at all. See, all of those, you are made that way. It doesn't mean you should accept them, or you can't change them, or you can't allow God to reframe them, but they're there. The third issue is that my past is under His sovereign control. I wouldn't be surprised if some of you still wrestle with issues of your past. I do. Things you've done, the way you've treated your kids, some things you did early in life. Mary has to constantly remind me that I cannot redo those first 2 or 3 years of having a little child where I was just out and about doing my own thing and telling her basically take care of the baby, you know. It was kind of a hindrance to come at this point, but, you know, or something. I didn't do that, but in action I did that, see. I was about my career, and here was the family, and okay, you handle that, and I'll handle this. Well, that really bugs me today when I think back on that. And once in a while I get down on myself and I have to recognize my past is under His sovereign control. With the morality the way it's going, there's going to be a lot of past that's going to have to be under God's sovereign control for people we're working with. And the last is that God will sustain and develop me into a more mature and happier person. God will sustain and develop me into a more mature and happier person. The next question is, what have I done wrong? And this is the doctrinal issue of grace versus works. Our system in the Navigators is prone to legalism. We all know that, don't we? Many, if not most, of the problems that we see emotionally come out of somewhat of a legalistic view of life. We do believe we're saved by grace, but it's very difficult for us to think we live by grace also. And so though we're saved by grace and have the doctrine of salvation very clear, that living by grace, as ye have therefore received Christ Jesus the Lord, so walk ye in Him, that it somehow doesn't come to pass in our lives. And the quiet time or scripture memory or those things becomes legalistic issues. Or we must produce in the ministry. I think our pressure for production hinders us many times. That doesn't mean it's bad. I'm just saying our response to it. See, nothing that the Navigators or the church or anyone else ever does makes you do anything. if we can see, do you see, we're responsible for ourselves and our responses. And I think the things we need to change to make sure that we don't put stumbling blocks in front of people. So grace versus works is a key issue that will come up again in midlife because, see, you won't be able to do the works you once did. The other issue is this one. What is God doing to me? Or the topic of spiritual maturity. Now, I'm not going to go down through that list because I want to leave the last 7, 8, 9 minutes for questions. But a little Bible study is just go down that list and write in a word or two of what a spiritually mature person is. God's whole purpose in bringing us through hard issues of life, through these transitions where we get to know ourselves better, is to help us become mature people. And even with gray hairs in our 50s or 60s, we may not be mature in certain areas. Or we can slip back into an adolescent attitude. It's very easy. You've seen yourself do it, and I've seen me do it. Worry about things that never worried before. Get angry about things that I never thought I would get angry about. And not act in a mature, godly way. So that's just an issue there. Now, the next item, and the last one that I would like to share with you, is the question, is it too late to get right with God, or the concept of forgiveness and restoration? Not forgiveness versus restoration, but forgiveness and restoration. That God is a rebuilder. I love the illustration that Mr. Sanders used. I think it was he. The potter, you know, it breaks down, then he rebuilds it. See, we're all given second chances. And there are times that we say, well, you know, can God really restore me to where I once was? You know, that's important emotionally. We think I'll never be like I once was. And at some point you can say, thank the Lord I won't be. Because what I was wasn't all that good. But the Lord has made something better. God never makes worse. He makes better. And just on a rebuilding, if you're helping someone with this, they need to assure their spiritual foundations, make sure they're there. Second is to admit the need to God and others. I think one of the problems is that we sometimes don't really admit our needs. We bottle it up and heat it up until it finally explodes. And it's very difficult for us to actually admit our need to God or to others. And finally, not finally, but thirdly, to be willing to start over in an area of our lives. You may need to redo your scripture memory system, you know, if that's something that's bugging you. And just realize that those 300 verses or whatever it was, that they are no longer memorized, they're just in the box. And that we just need to keep rebuilding. And, you know, do whatever we need to do, if that's an important thing to you. But that's not as important to God. He wants your life changed, not your scripture memory plan. I'm very positive on scripture memory, incidentally, but I'm just saying that we get into some traps. And lastly, we just need to set some goals, some measurable things to get started, to rebuilding and to understand what the Lord is doing in our lives. I believe that God really wants to work through us. In midlife is when we finally are at a point where I believe we're qualified to be an elder. Most people in their 20s and early 30s, they do a great job in ministry, but frankly, they, in the main, do not meet a lot of the spiritual qualifications. They're still growing. This is a time when from now on, we can have the greatest contribution of our lives. We have the background, the experience, the wisdom. We know the word. But, you know, Satan somehow just brings issues into our lives, that warfare going on. You know, our children have problems, and the job doesn't satisfy us, and things shake us up, and etc. And try and disturb the great contribution that God wants us to make. And I pray to God that at this point in my life, that from here on, I'll see greater contribution. Not so much to the work, that's God's. Whatever God wants to do there, that's fine. But to the kingdom of God, that you will be a mature, godly counselor, man and woman of the word, to be able to help others, to be able to be open about the trauma you're going through personally, to be able to share where you hurt and to learn from it and to keep growing. But it's a little painful. And we usually, the mode normally is to bottle up and to close out and not allow anyone else into our lives. Well, let me stop there. We've got about 5 minutes, and maybe there are just some general questions you'd like to bring up or some comments that you'd like to make. As you can see, none of this, I don't think, is particularly innovative or new. You knew it. It's just good to have it perhaps organized in a way to think things through. And I picked it up from other people, and maybe it'll just help you a little bit in your own perspective. So why don't we just interact for a few minutes on questions or thoughts that you may have, or perhaps an experience of your own life to verify one of those things. Yes.
Jerry, when somebody comes to you that's in the, you know, in the middle of this crisis, what do you do with them first?
Find out, let them talk. People in the middle of a crisis don't normally need solutions. They need to be able to express it without condemnation. At least that's what I want. I don't want someone to give me all the answers. Now, I make that mistake. You know, Mary will say, okay, I just got to talk to you, and some tears come, and I say, well, let's see now. The Bible and logic and, you know, what can you do against Bible and logic? But all she wanted was for me to listen. And I think we want that. So listen first and just see if there are some issues that may come up, and then very gently begin to center in on what may have caused this and help them begin to rebuild spiritually, or maybe there's something they need to do differently relating to their children. Find out where they need some help and really want some, and something that's very easy for them to do. Don't give complicated solutions. Like for depression. What do you do about depression? Well, time is probably one of the biggest healers, isn't it? And rest is probably one of the biggest medicines. Just plain rest. Backing away. And there's very little you can say to someone who's in depression that will bring them out. But as people have shared to me, one man shared a few days ago, it's just so deep, I didn't think I'd ever come out. And he'd never been depressed before. Okay, some other thoughts? Does this stuff kind of make sense to you in the organization, and if you, can you relate to it a little in your own life with things you've gone through or are going through? Yeah.
It seems to me that in the 20s there is something like this. When a person gets married, has children, and career responsibilities and potentially ministry responsibility on top of that, that all of a sudden, you know, they've got to make a choice that, you know, they're no longer living in a home with their parents. They're
right.
Responsible for this whole ball of wax. Do you see that happen?
Yes, it does. It does happen, but it doesn't have the same effect. They've got high physical reserves generally, fairly high emotional reserves, and they just gut it out. And, you know, they just sort of plow through, and it never surfaces. I occasionally would see it at age 30, you know, about there. There are other comments I can make on that, but I think our response to it, the things is different. The things that happen in our 20s are similar, but we respond to it differently in our 30s and our 40s. That's what it seems to be anyhow. Just that's evidential that I see that happening. And I think there are some biblical examples of that too. For instance, in our 20s, we might have had more discipline in our 40s, but we tend to get a little soft, for instance. Yes?
I was just going to say, I think in a way, in our own lives and counseling of people, it can be comforting just to know this is the process. I mean, this is kind of normal for us.
Yeah, and that's right. It is a very normal thing. Yeah, people don't, and many people never get a crisis.
Did you realize you're 43? Oh, yeah, that's right. You know,
yeah.
And that can be encouraging, too.
Right.
As I get older, I see people in my generation, the end thing is to slow down, to look to retirement, and I think some of us have a real privilege in being able to. I like to be around younger people because it's a challenge to me, and I remember what you said about having somebody check up on you, because I think the older I get, I find out the more I need that. And I think, but our society has a tendency to gear us to slowing up, doing things that are not that challenging. Your mind is not challenged. You just sit around the rocking chair in this group. Get out there and do something and be involved in the community.
Yeah, it is easy to slow down, and of course there are some areas you should slow down. I mean, it's just a fact of life, but that doesn't mean the quality or the quantity of what you do is going to be any less. I think you have to be a little more selective of what you do. You may want to choose the right things. It's not that you have so much less capacity. In fact, I believe that your emotional capacity does increase with age. However, the emotional drains go almost faster because of the children, the job, our age, our health, and see, so the emotional load gets bigger. But, you know, people see Mary, and some of you older gals that have had people around your home a lot and done a lot of things, they just stand back and they say, how do you do it? And Lila, I bet, you know, people say, how did you do it? Well, you learn over a period of time. I go into Cease and Thelma's home with a number of people they have living. Well, they've figured out how to do it, and they've learned some hard lessons, see. But that experience, they have actually increased their capacity as they've gotten older. Your physical capacity goes down. Your emotional capacity goes up is a general rule. You may not think so, but I do believe that that happens. And your ability to minister in depth increases if you are growing with the Lord. But there's no assurance of growth, you know. Dave? This will be our last question here.
Chapter that's been a real help to me in the story of depression is 1 Kings 19.
Mm-hmm.
And over after the thing with Elijah, he said,
kill
me, I'm
Oh, yeah, Elijah, yeah.
How God deals with him, you know.
Yeah. Right, there's some excellent ones. And I apologize for not going into a lot of those detailed scripture things, because I wanted to give you an outline of that center part, which I think is foundational to the rest of the other issues. Well, I appreciate your taking the risk and coming in to a session like this. Let's have a word of prayer as we close, shall we? Father, thank you for our friendships in this room. I thank you for just the maturity that is in this conference, the experience, the wisdom that you have stored up. And I pray that there would be no person in this conference who, because of age, think that they're over the hill, but would understand that you are going to use them more and more and more. Thank you for the example of Mr. Sanders, who keeps retiring and keeps going. God, we pray that that would be the case with us, and that we would not grasp on to that which younger people ought to do, but we would always be reaching forward to the contribution that you have for us at this time of our lives. Thanks, Lord, for our children and for all that trauma, as hard as it is on us at times. And we thank you that you are doing your perfect work in our lives. And when we have been tried, we shall come forth as gold. And we praise you for that. In Jesus' name, amen.